You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, welcome to Bookworm. My guest this afternoon is Maurice Sendak, and, you know, it's a Bookworm holiday whenever he's here. The occasion for this visit is the republication in paperback of E.T.A. Hoffman's Nutcracker, with pictures by Maurice Sendak, published by Crown. This is the first real translation of Hoffman's Nutcracker into English. It's a very beautiful translation by Ralph Manheim. And, you know, I thought we'd begin by talking about Hoffman, because he's one of those authors that one loves without really liking.
Yeah. It's, or reading.
Yeah, yeah.
And I admit, when I think previous to this project of the Nutcracker, I don't know how much Hoffman I read. The only thing I'd read, because Freud had recommended it, was
The Sandman,
of course. And some of the short tales. I knew the Mines of Falun. Falun, is that
Falun,
it?
Falun, yeah.
Yep. And yes, I had, and Coppelia, of course. But I didn't read The Nutcracker, actually. And I haven't even read the long novelettes or short novels. So I didn't know that much about him, except he was a composer and that he wrote operas, which was successful, which we don't have, so far as I know, a shred of. And that A in his name is for Amadeus, which he chose, an homage to you-know-who.
Well, I know who. But how did this come to be composed by Tchaikovsky?
Let me think. Something like at the beginning, like in the 1890s, the Bolshoi, Swan Lake had been a big success, and they wanted another major ballet with Tchaikovsky. They wanted a Christmas ballet, so the Nutcracker was commissioned, and it was very, very loosely based on the Hoffman. And there's journal extracts from Tchaikovsky. And he was a big crab anyway. He moaned and groaned about everything. And he probably actually had good reason to. But he was worried about this project because there was nothing that he could actually get his hands on. And he was right, because what they gave him was a ghost of the original fairy tale.
By way of Dumas, was it?
You're right. By way of Dumas Pale, yeah, which is the way the Nutcracker is mostly known in Europe, not through Hoffman, but through Dumas. And Dumas had conventionalized it, turned it into a four-square little story. And Hoffman is anything but that. It's berserker. It goes flying all over the place.
Well, that, you know, I did a little bit of study of this because it's an effect that I love. Hoffman was part of this movement in German literature, toward the end of it, of romantic irony. And the idea here is that romantic irony, other generations have liked different things about Hamlet. What the romantics liked about him was that you don't know whether or not he's crazy. Mm-hmm. There's a constant whirling effect, says, I think it's Schiller, in the essay on romantic irony, that we should always be uncertain of what ground we are on. And Hoffman's version of that, in story after story, is to take a central story and invent a frame tale for it and excursions in and out, different styles that keep parading through. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of feeling, you know, when you're reading The Nutcracker in Manheim's translation, you feel like you're falling asleep in a very pleasant way, because there's so much fancy, there's so much embellishment, that you almost feel wretched excess. What you are, in fact, feeling is the effects of this romantic irony. And it's sometimes better embodied in the scarier stories, mm-hmm. Like Sandman.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what I thought, you know, when I was thinking about this, was that this is perfect Sendak material, because it is about penetration of frames. My favorite bit of Hoffman is the bit in The Sandman in which the children are told that if they don't fall asleep, the Sandman will come. And what he will do, this German Sandman, is take their eyes out, mm-hmm. that he'll put them in a sack and take them to the moon. He flies there, where he'll give them to the moon owls to gnaw on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this...
That'll certainly put you to bed.
Well, I thought, you know, that, you know, someone who wants to take children's eyes to the moon for the owls, I mean, these are, you know, very quintessential Sendakiana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see the practicality of that.
So you had an initial reticence in this book to take on the Nutcracker because of its sweetness?
Well, because I knew it only from the productions that I saw in New York and maybe one or two other cities, and I presumed in my ignorance that that's what the Nutcracker was. Well, in fact, actually, that is what the Nutcracker is. There was never that much, as I said, of Hoffmann up on the stage to begin with, which is what Tchaikovsky complained about, that it was vapido, that there was nothing there, actually. But there must have been enough for him, or I suspect he read his Hoffmann, because it's one of the best scores he's ever done. And while there is a vapidity to what's so-called dramatically going on stage, there is not so to the music. It's very toothy and gnarly and stomach noisy. I mean, it is Hoffmann. It's really very good. About your romantic irony with all the stuff that's going on in that fairy tale, the endless fancy, as you say, what strikes me and what is so touching is that one of the points made, and for me the crucial point, is about Clara, that she is an artist, that she is a child who dreams, and the kind of condescension she gets from her parents. And at the end of the story, the little bit of sadness that she isn't going to be quite a regular girl. She's not. That's really what it's about to me, that she is really treated rather poorly, even by loving parents, because she's an imaginative child. I quite wonder about her. Did this actually happen? And she's not like a tiresome little brother who's going to grow up to be a major in the army, but who will be loved more and appreciated more because he's a regular kid. This is a story about an artist in the family who puzzles the parents and thus is unwittingly segregated away from them, and that's how she's going to grow up in isolation in some form.
Well, I would even go further. Knowing the rest of Hoffmann, I think that implicit in this stream of honey rivers and lemonade seas and this and that is an implicit criticism of what is given to children, what the imagination is of children is like. Now, when we see Nutcracker at Christmas time, children are supposed to be delighted. I think Hoffmann is, in fact, sickened by the procession of sweet things.
He has to be because he proceeds to give you all the marzipan, but then he has some ogre come in this marvelous land where everything is this Shangri-La for kiddies, then how come there's this grotesque beast who comes and eats all this up? Meaning there's no safe place to be.
There's no safe place to be, but not only that, by the end of this story, all of the toys in that toy cabinet have been destroyed.
Yes.
And the Nutcracker is no longer there. He's human and sort of vapid.
Yeah. It's growing up.
You compare this to other of Hoffmann's stories, and he loves, you know, writing about Princess Bambilla, which is a story full of insects. He wrote Kater Moore, which is
a
book narrated by a cat.
I mean,
gorgeous. Magnificent. Yeah. And, you know, he's not given to treacle. His work is a critique of treacle in a way. And, you know, there's a funny thing, because the Nutcracker becomes known ultimately as the most famous.
But isn't that the ultimate irony, that they would have missed the irony
of
the story? Of course, that the ballet ends in Bad Toothville.
Yes, you know? Yes.
And it's so silly that it should end in that place, because that is just what he's making fun of rather viciously, actually.
Yeah, it's... It one should come away from the Nutcracker with a stomach ache.
Yeah. Instead of nauseated.
Now, this was one of your first productions, yes, that you designed, the Nutcracker.
No, it was the first ballet.
The first
ballet.
Yeah,
the first ballet. I had done three operas previous to that. This is the first and only ballet since. I'm very anxious, and hopefully I will do another one.
But I wanted to make the transition to your ongoing projects in your children's theater, The Night Kitchen. What is in the wings?
What is in the wings are various productions, happily all different, so that we get across the idea which is very crucial to me, that the Night Kitchen is not a children's theater per se, but is also, we have Hansel and Gretel by Humperdinck, the big opera, which would be produced with Toronto and New York and Night Kitchen. We have Peter Pan, which is your play, but we will have our way with that play. Arthur Yorings, who is my partner and who is a marvelous writer and librettist, he will write Peter Pan. I will design Peter Pan. We have Really Rosie, which is a tiny, tiny little musical. So there's a whole variety. So there's Rosie, there's Peter Pan, there's Hansel and Gretel, there's Hey Al, which is a book by Arthur that he was turning into an operetta, and Peter Schickele is composing the music for. I love the variety of the things that we're planning now, and they will all be in other people's theaters because we don't have a theater.
Are you looking for a theater to have?
No, we don't want a theater. It'll be expensive, and we're going to have to. We're a poor, not-for-profit children's theater, so we're not looking to be paying rent on anything. And so, there's Really Rosie is in the Edison Theater in St. Louis, and Hansel is in the Toronto Opera House and the New York City Opera House, and Hey Al is in the Houston Grand Opera, and et cetera, et cetera. There's no need to own an opera house. And also, I want to get the show on the road.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, with luck, and if we're successful, then other places will want it, and we'll tour.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Last night, William H. Gass approached you and asked you if you would read with the best of children's writers in St. Louis at the Washington University. And I wanted to intercede for you. I found myself wanting to say, well, does it have to be with children's writers? Well, why can't it be with any other kind of wonderful writer? But here you have a children's theater. Is this a willful self?
No. It's a real... This whole what we're talking about is irony that continues, because I would never have wanted to call it a children's theater.
That's what I thought.
Well, we have to, because that's my name and that's Arthur's name, and we're kind of stuck with it. And you know why I would be bothered by that, because it's reduction. It isn't a children's theater any more than my books are just children's books. But we have to call it that, because otherwise we won't be able to raise the money for it, and that is what I am known for. Being a children's book writer and illustrator. I struggled valiantly, Michael, through most of my young years, beating my head against the wall and trying to sort of get rid of those categories and rid of those pigeonholes, but I couldn't do it.
I found myself telling people last night that what I felt was that adults go to your books for the same things that children go for, that it's not a nostalgic trip, but that the same sense of inspiration of being at the wellspring of something is there for adults and children. Children may have less far to go to get there than adults do.
Well, they have immediate access to it.
Right.
Yeah.
Their interpretations are what? From the heart.
Mm-hmm. And from the belly button. Or lower.
Oh, this again.
No, I speak of viscera.
Now, I also noticed as we were talking, and this did get commented on, that recently your work has turned from the animal presence, the sexuality of children, to the death of children.
Hmm.
Can you speak about that a bit?
Yeah, but I don't think it turns as though it were, I did that, and now I do that.
Uh-huh.
I'm not on a course, you know, of action, or yes. I've done with sex, now it's on to death. It just turned out that way. It just turned out that way. If another erotic piece bloomed in my head, I would do that. There was no planned attack there, creatively speaking. The books just came in that process, in that order, I mean. So that, of course, it was wonderful that they did, because the timing of Dear Millie was extraordinary. But you can't count on that happening. Who knew such a letter existed? Who knew we'd get our hands on it first in the United States? Who knew I'd illustrate it? Who knew I'd end up with a letter? So that, in fact, it was all...
serendipity.
I guess.
Or something. Yeah.
I don't know what.
Uh-huh.
Coincidence.
What kind of language, if you were to talk about the kind of language that you feel is appropriate or best for children's books. We've never spoken about this before. We've talked about the pictures. What kind of language is that?
Ooh. Very unpainted language. Very unvarnished language. Very rough-hewn, poetic, rough-hewn, blunt language. Arranged in a very clear, poetic order. If there's any embellishment or floral arrangements, it's in the pictures. It's not in the language. The best writers always were most incredibly direct and very, very simple. I don't mean simple-minded. I mean simple to the point, like a dart going to the heart of the situation. It's very hard to do. Very hard to do.
So none of these verbal effects, no onomatopoeia, no, really.
Mm-hmm. Not that one is conscious of. Like, people ask me lots and some complained of the language and outside over there. Like, why was it all item-mad? And wasn't that a conceit of language? But no, it wasn't. That's how I heard it. And it's as though the whole story is as though she were looking in a mirror and everything is backwards. So she does everything wrong. She does everything backwards. And so the writing came out backwards. Mm-hmm. That's how simple-minded I am. I mean, that's how I saw it. It came out that way. And it sounded right to me. Mm-hmm. And then later, strange poetry and strange sentence structure. And strange, strange, strange. You can say strange till you're blue in the face, but that isn't a conscious thing you do. You don't sit down and write backwards poetry. You're so flooded by the work. Yes, you're literally flooded by the work when you're doing it, so that you can't but write it in the way it comes out.
So there's no which came first, the words or the music here. It's a whole vision.
It's a whole vision, but the words come first.
They do.
Oh, yeah. You have the vision. I don't care for the word. I can't think of a better word. You see something. It excites you very, very much. It isn't literal. It isn't like a graphic image or a sequence of pictures. It's something that, I'm sorry, just the word, it floods you. Something floods you. And then you write towards that image. You don't draw towards it. You write towards it. You construct something that goes in the direction of that image. And then it only goes so far. And then you can draw too. And then the pictures go further. Mm-hmm. And further. And you go towards something which you see. If I had to force this into language, I would say in a book like Outside Over There, I did see something. The clouds didn't part, and there was no wonderful head came out of the heavens, alas. But what I saw, and it has always stayed with me, was like a very crude photograph, almost like a Polaroid, okay? And it was in black and white. And in the background was a woman, an 18th century woman, who was in a room, curtains on either side of her, and she's looking out pensively into the street. There's a very small balcony. She's oversized. She has a small head and a big body. And in the foreground, in the shadows, dark, there are curtains, and there's a little girl watching her in a tempest of rage. Just an impatient little girl. Like, what the hell is she doing? What the hell is she doing? A wrathful girl. And that's what I saw. And that's what I wrote towards.
Now, many of your phrases have entered the language. In big and small ways. I guess the most famous is "Let the Wild Rumpus Start." And I was thinking, you know, about "Let the Wild Rumpus Start." Why the wild rumpus? Because a rumpus is already wild. And I realized that it was the rumpus of the wild things. Mm-hmm. It's the wild rumpus. but how does that come about?
Oh, by great pain. I remember looking for that word forever, because that's a great turn, that's a great twist in the story, that's peak higher than everything that's happened. So you do word lists and word lists and word lists, and you try them out on Ursula, your friend and editor, you try them out on yourself, and you and then you get the word you like best. It's just so hard, that's all. And then you're not sure, is that the word right? Does that sound right? I remember Rumpus all right. I'll never forget it as long as I live. Coming to asking everybody, like the Ancient Mariner, do you like the word rumpus? Do you like the word rumpus? Do you think it's going to be all right?
You mean there was a list in which there was hoopla?
Oh, yes, and geferlach.
I see. Yeah, so these are where the Wildehayas are. This was
that's
once.
Right.
Yes.
Well, yes, yes. Wildehaya. We know what that means, wild things in Yiddish. Yes, there were words that sounded Yiddishy when I chose it, thinking that might be the right way to go. Oh, I remember friends I tormented until I got their approval, because even though you're going to end up by deciding, you want the approval of your friends. I remember. It's funny that I'd come into the language thinking how arduous it was to give birth to.
Well, I do think about that, you know, that one. When I imagine that the writing of a children's book is the process of pairing, and what I see when I visualize this is the people who cut whalebone. You know, that there's some instrument from which excess things are scraped out of sentences. And these things, you know, fall to the floor in a clump, and they leave very clean sentences mm-hmm. behind. You know, these are the sentences. And then, you know, how do we make sure that these sentences are graven on the mind. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's repetition that does it, but something there is, you know, that doesn't love a wall, that something there is that leaves your sentences very, you know, vividly plain and present.
Now, Michael, you're about one of the very few people I know who talks about this as though it were a serious art form. I don't want to let this pass and just seem like cavalier about, because I don't. It's really marvelous, because you always have. I mean, it's one of the many reasons why we talk and we're friends. But you're discussing this in a way I can't tell you. I can't answer all your questions because I don't know the answers.
No,
but you
no
don't
answers.
Make a discrimination here. You don't make a discrimination between this kind of writing and this kind of poetry or any other kind of writing or poetry. That's perfectly clear. But you're really almost alone in that non-prejudice.
And very lonely.
It's a song.
Well, thank you very much.
But it's true.
Great honor. Well, what I want to ask you about is that I hear you are returning to Mother Goose in not your next book, but the book after that.
Yeah.
And this will be the first time since Hector Protector?
That's correct. Goodness, did I tell you this?
Well, you did.
I guess I'm not too ready to really talk about it, to be perfectly honest.
Really?
Yeah, I'm not, no, because it's now in that tremulous condition, you know, am I going to stay pregnant?
Uh-huh.
It's too delicate.
Is that what happens?
Yeah.
Does it go away?
Yeah, sure. Well, you worry that it'll go away.
Mm-hmm.
You worry that it isn't there.
Well, then can we take a step back and talk about Pierre?
Oh, sure, that I feel much better about.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
You mean the real Pierre?
Yes, the real
Melville's
Pierre.
Melville's Pierre.
Yeah. We share an enormous... We both think that Melville is the greatest American writer, and sometimes that he's greater than the greatest American writer. And you are doing a centennial edition of Pierre.
Except that it'll be too late for his centennial, because that'll end next month. But it'll come out in a year or two, and it'll fly in the face of everything I've ever said, which is that you shouldn't illustrate grown-up books, and you shouldn't illustrate books by the great masters, not because there's something sacred, but that they don't need pictures. And I said this at a meeting in Pittsfield. We were all sitting around talking, Melville lovers. And they were saying, why don't you do pictures? And I said, I'd love to do pictures, but I can't. I love and respect the man too much. He doesn't need anything from me. And this woman, like the Delphic Oracle, said, well, you sound like you know what you're talking about, but in fact, you don't. She said, you wrote your own little Pierre when you were a young man, and you didn't realize that that's what was feverishly working in your head. Now, she said, it's time for you to take it up. Go home. Read Pierre again and make your own mind, but that's the book you should be doing.
Well, one of the things that interests me, okay, that you are taking up Pierre, is that having perfected the pastoral. You're now being asked to produce the ironic pastoral, the clumsy, clumpy, dumpy pastoral. And that, you know, self-consciously, Pierre is written in
viciously
thick,
pastiched,
clumpy
yes.
prose.
Right, right. It's such a daring book. And, of course, it's going to mean I'm going to have to be daring, too. But I have one out that Herman didn't have. I don't have to produce this book if I don't want to. If my pictures fail to accomplish what I wish them to accomplish, no one will ever see them. So he's braver than I am. I mean, he put himself out there with that weird book. God knows what he thought he was doing. God knows what he thought he was doing. Alas, he never really said so. He never writes, never kept journals, and he didn't say anything about it, except the most banal things in letters.
Except talk about romantic irony, that quality of spinning and spinning and not knowing where you're standing. Is he serious? Is he joking? Is he crazy? That is the effect
yes,
of Pierre.
Yes, you are worn out trying to guess, is he out of his mind? Did he intend this? Is this a joke? What is going on? Well, he really does leave you on your own, as very few writers do. And the point is, you have to, you don't have to, but I strongly recommend you do trust him. The great fun of it, Michael, on a simple level, is like from chapter one, which you know how bizarre chapter one is, how he expected anyone to go from chapter one to chapter two, I do not know. But he did. Apparently he did. And that first chapter is so crazy. And the dial is up in thick gothic colors that are mind-boggling. I've come to love it now.
Me too.
But I yeah. just love it. But then the dial changes and the colors change, and he keeps changing the style, and he writes like Stephen King, and then he writes like Judith Krantz, and then he writes like Danielle Steele, and then he writes like Herman Melville. And you just have to grin and bear it. But what that allows for me to do as an artist, to change my style throughout the entire book, I will be following the dial as I see it, as uh-huh. I believe it. So my pictures will change all through the book, all through the book.
Well, this is something I want to see. You know, it's very hard to illustrate a book whose subtitle is The Ambiguities.
Well, you can get away with murder, right?
It's one of the ambiguities.
It's one of the ambiguities. You know, tell me about it. You don't like it? That's what I meant. It's one of the ambiguities. Correct. Well, we're not going to do that, of course.
I've been talking to my friend Maurice Sendak, and thank you for coming here.
We finished.
We're finished.
Wow. Thanks, Michael.
For the time being. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Theo Mandel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Bookworm, heard every week at this time on KCRW. Coming up next from the world of international business, Marketplace. You know, the overlap between the groups that love Maurice Sendak and those that love PDQ Bach must be just about 100%. So listen.
Hello, I'm Peter Schickele. You might remember me as the man who discovered PDQ Bach and the 1712 Overture. After winning 3 Grammys and Billboard's Top Classical Crossover Album of the Year Award, I've finally sold out to public radio. I'll be spending Saturday nights on KCRW in the studio down the hall, mixing my favorite CDs, cassettes, and records. Remember those? Join me for Schickele Mix, an hour of good music, classical and otherwise, Saturday nights at 8 on KCRW.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old.